This is Cheryl Paul, and I am delighted to be here with Alanis Morissette talking about the topic of change and transitions and rites of passages, which is a topic that receives very little attention in our culture. And Alanis happens to be going through several transitions right now, so I'm very excited to be talking to her about her experience with those. I think you know, Alanis, that my work in transitions is centered around the three stages, but I'd like to go over those briefly for our listeners that might not be familiar with the language of transitions. So, stage one is the letting go or separation stage, and this is when you recognize that the old identity and the lifestyle is ending, and you take the time to grieve and let go of aspects of yourself that are no longer serving you. So this is the packing up stage of moving. This is the engagement of the wedding transition. This is pregnancy. And stage two is called the liminal stage. These are based on the work of a man named Arnold Van Gennep, who wrote a book called Rites of Passage in 1916. He termed this second stage liminal, where you're in between the old life and the new, in between identities. It's the chrysalis stage or the cocoon stage, where the caterpillar has not yet transformed into a butterfly. And it's characterized by feeling disoriented, lonely, vulnerable, and uncertain. It's often the most difficult stage of a transition for people, especially when they don't know what's happening. And learning about these stages of transition gives people the context and the vocabulary to ground them and contain them, makes them feel like they have a compass and a rudder when they're feeling lost in the middle of the ocean. So this is the woman around the time of her wedding, when she's no longer non-married, but not quite feeling like she's a wife yet, getting to terms with that identity. It's also the pregnant woman as she nears labor and the new mother just after she gives birth. And then we move into stage three, which is the new beginning or the rebirth, when we emerge into the new life. This is the birth of the butterfly, the birth of the new identity as a wife or a mother. It's finding your sea legs at a new job or sending down the first roots in a new house or a new neighborhood. And as we become more comfortable with the external adjustments and identities, so we access new resources within ourselves, more patience, tolerance, compassion, and wisdom. And this is really the gift of transition. When you move through it consciously, you recognize that by going through those first two stages, enduring the challenges, you have access to becoming a more expanded version of yourself, and it's really a very spiritual process. So that said, with the laying the groundwork, thank you. Can you talk about your recent transitions, or really any transitions, in this context, what it's been like for you to let go, to be in that in-between realm, and to experience a rebirth or a new beginning?
Yeah, I think the liminal, I call it the abyss stage, is probably my least favorite, no matter which transition I'm going through. So I think of transitions, professionally speaking, I think of, you know, going on tour, the preparatory stages of going on tour and then adjusting to the first few shows and then actually fully being on tour and committed and in the rhythm of that. And then the biggest transitions I felt from as far back as I can remember as an artist were the transitions after a play would close or after a tour would be finished or even after a record creation would be done. There was that calm after the storm where I would just I would be very glazed over and a little shell-shocked and very grief-struck. And I didn't know how to deal with the grief, so I thought there was something wrong, especially when I was younger. And then as I came to go through a lot of these different phases and transitions, I came to see that grief was such a big part of the process in a way that I hadn't been taught about or prepared for, really. And then with regards to marriage, it was really an important part of it for me was to be aware of these transitions based on having read Conscious Bride, which was a huge help. And then I also had the privilege a few years ago of having had some one-on-one sessions with you to the point where I at least intellectually was prepared for the three stages. But then really the rubber hit the road and I started experiencing them viscerally and physically, and, you know, the senses were all affected by them. So the first stage of really the dawning for me of becoming ready to change an entire identity, there was some kicking and screaming on my part, a lot of my unconscious was freaking out, and I was having all kinds of dreams of loss and dreams of fear and dreams of things going wrong and dreams of being trapped, and, you know, all my unconscious fears were definitely in my face. And because I'd been steeled and prepared for this concept to arise during the transition, I just kept going and I kept, you know, processing the dreams, and a lot of the thoughts that came up that were fear-based were really, you know, just false. And so one by one, I would just look at them. And also survival was so much based on my individualism, you know, especially with marriage. So partnership is such a huge activism as I now see it. You know, I think it's part of what will heal this entire planet on a macro scale. So I knew it was something I wanted to embark upon, and I wanted to do it as harmoniously as I possibly could, but it flew in the face of what I'd always deemed to be a very worthy survival strategy of individualism. So I had to look at all the thoughts that kept me from taking the plunge and doing that, you know, making that huge commitment. So the first stages were a lot of resistance, still a willingness to move forward. I knew that it was part of my next spiritual step and my next big leap in my journey. So there was no question that I would continue to move toward the real sort of healthy, harmonious version of partnership that I'd always dreamed of and envisioned, but it wasn't without struggle. So that first stage was the kicking and screaming phase.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is for so many, many people. And even though you had the information, I mean, that's probably what helped you in part be able to keep going and move through it. But what I love about transitions is that they're the great equalizer, that it doesn't matter who you are or how old you are or, you know, when you choose to get married or when, you know, you take that next job, or when you have a baby, or man or woman, or where you live, that everybody ends up going through these same stages. And it's hard, you know. And the thing about the wedding, which I come across all the time in my work with clients, is the idea the shock of how come no one told you that it was supposed to feel, that it was going to feel this way and even supposed to feel this way, because there's so much fantasy around the engagement and the proposal and the, you know, the wedding and the planning, and you're supposed to be so joyous.
And yeah, every bridal magazine has the beaming, flawless bride who's jumping up and down with joy.
Exactly.
Or the other projection out there is the bridezilla, right?
Yes.
These extremes. So it's either some freaked out control freak, freaked out woman, or blissed out, floaty on the cloud. And for me, it was, you know, it's a combination of all kinds of aspects of self. And one thing that really helped me through, which you are such an advocate of and a describer of, is the archetypes really helped me through, you know, really embracing what aspect of self is really going to help me through this particular phase. You know, so the mother, the queen, the princess, the maiden, all these sweet aspects of being a female really, really helped me through, and helped me through some of the more emotional times too. So archetypes were a huge friend for me.
That's great. And when you were in the grief, what allowed you to grieve, and how did you grieve? Was it waking up from the dream and just writing it down and processing it and crying, or what was most helpful to you in processing that grieving experience?
Yeah, what it looked like for me, every morning I had the luxury of carving out 2 hours to be alone every morning, and I would just sob. So I would, you know, I'd read a little bit of your book, Conscious Bride, or go through the planner. I was journaling a lot. I was processing my dreams. I was talking to a lot of my girlfriends who I could bounce a lot of this stuff off of. But mostly I was praying and just looking at all these false thoughts of what I felt wife meant, of what I felt partnership would mean. You know, a lot of my addictive qualities of part of what came along with my individualism was pretty heavy workaholism too, to the point where there was no room for partnership. So I really had to look at that. I had to be willing to look at a lot of my addictive processes and, you know, things I'd leaned on during times of heavy workload chapters. So I really wanted to look at those because I didn't want my now husband to be subject to, you know, to neglect, frankly. So it wasn't just me embracing what wife was, which in and of itself was a huge piece, but what is also looking at a lifestyle that really wasn't prepared. The soil was not tilled to be the kind of wife and the kind of partner that I wanted to be.
And I imagine the kind of mother as well.
Yeah, and that wasn't, you know, it was just in my mind, you know,
right,
pretty shortly thereafter.
Mind, but and this is how it happens with transitions, and people don't always go in order, but when they do, that one does help you prepare for the next so that you're able to work on these aspects of yourself that you can see aren't serving you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is one of the points I try to convey to my clients over and over again, is that I know it feels really hard right now and you just want to get over it and get through it, but there's so much, there's so many gifts to be reaped, and there's such an opportunity for growth and, you know, for expanding who you are, and like you're saying, that to be able to be confronted with this addictive part of yourself that you knew wouldn't serve a partnership, and that it was probably coming, that transitions magnify and they amplify the parts of yourself that, you know, that just aren't going to serve you anymore.
Yeah, and the need to fall away, and I love the metaphor
yes.
you used of the caterpillar, because the there were habits and there were definitely a large amount of thoughts that just weren't serving not only partnership, but weren't serving future motherhood and just weren't serving the vision that I had on a political, social, emotional, spiritual level, you know, because I knew that where I was moving, just purely on an evolution of consciousness level, I was moving toward letting myself feel and letting myself be affected and, you know, healing a lot of wounds from my childhood to the point where I'd be able to be intimate with another human being, whether it's my
yes.
husband or my future children. And there was just a lot of work for me to do. And I'd always prided myself on having done so much work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I was going, wow, this really feels like I've barely begun. So it was a whole other deepening level of inner work that, you know, that was quite beautiful. And there were payoffs in a way that I'd never felt before, because even though I'd done a lot of work and gone to tons of workshops and kind of prided myself on having been brave enough to do that, a lot of it had been intellectualized up until this point. So now it was almost like I was being rendered very human, very in the body, very actually happening, versus wow, you're planning on it, you're reading about it, you're intellectualizing it.
Yes,
this is an application that was being required of me.
Yes,
it was terrifying.
There's nothing like intimacy, you know. There's
yeah.
nothing like a partnership to do that, and that's one of the another one of the points I always try to convey is you can get away with a lot until you are ready to really commit to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it is the biggest commitment, and those fears of intimacy just come flying right up to the surface once you know that you're planning to make that commitment.
Yeah, and I know some people who get married and they,
yes,
you know, they're still resistant of intimacy, and I've always known that the quality of interaction that I've always wanted and dreamed
yes.
of was a profoundly intimate one. So I knew that if this was going to be the dream come true embarkation that it has now become, I knew that I couldn't just, you know, I couldn't just skim the surface as I was doing this. And it just
right.
wasn't kind of the kind of partnership that I would have wanted. So I knew the rubber had to hit the road.
Right. And it's fairly recent for you. So do you feel like you have moved beyond, I mean, the stages don't always happen linearly. It'd be nice if life happened ABC.
Wouldn't it?
This doesn't, it'd be nice, but, you know, it tends to be more murky than that and more of
yeah.
a spiral, you know, experience than a linear
yeah.
one. But you have moved beyond the wedding day, and, you know, does it feel like you are now in the rebirth stage of your wedding transition?
I'm getting there. There's the combination of pregnancy and
yes.
integration of wifedom. So every once in a while, there's still the element of me saying, oh, yeah, I'll check with my husband, and someone will giggle. Your husband. So there's still the giggling of the monikers and the labels of the new
yes.
rebirth version.
Yes.
And then there are times where I just feel like I've been married for years already. But what I love about it is that I feel like I'm redefining it for myself outside of what marriage meant for my parents, outside of what even society's expectations of what the institution once was. And so there is an element of unrecognizability that I've now finally become comfortable with feeling uncertain and in that floaty phase, whereas before I resisted it so much and I would have made a reactionary choice just to stop that liminal floaty feeling. I hated it. Whereas
yeah.
now it's kind of become an old friend, really.
Uh-huh.
You know, professionally.
So that was actually, yeah, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because it's such a challenging place to be, that uncertain, floaty, amorphous liminal stage. And I think it's probably the key factor that sends people calling me or to my websites or wherever, trying to get ground and get information that's going to take away that feeling. And, mm-hmm. you know, what can you articulate what has helped you surrender to that floaty uncertainty?
I think some of the Gestalt Buddhist practice work, like Pema Chodron and work
mm-hmm.
with you, and a lot of the somatic Peter Levine work has helped
yep.
me in the not resisting, you know, Debbie Ford's shadow work. There's so many amazing teachers out there, of which you are one, and I consider myself to be part of this group of the non-resistance. You know, it's to not resist the feeling of floating or terror, or, you know, because I spent a lot of my life trying to run away from certain feelings, and that's where my suffering began. Pain in and of itself, I can tolerate it. You know, I can
yes.
sit in it and breathe through it and maybe even sometimes enjoy it. but when I
well, there is a release that comes after a good sob. You know?
Yeah,
there is a release that does feel good. But yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
And when I can push through the shame of it, if I have any around it, it's great. But I think what has helped me during those uncertain, amorphous, floaty times is the not resisting it. So if I'm in
yeah.
pain, or if I'm in grief, or if I'm angry, or if I'm frustrated, or if I'm, you know, whatever, all the sort of darker shadow aspects of life, if I resist it, I'm in trouble and there's a lot of suffering for me.
Yeah.
But if I can breathe and see it as one aspect of my humanity, and that, you know, I spent a lot of years trying to sort of spiritually escape some of the human parts, and then I went all the other end of the spectrum, where it was all about psychology and spirituality, and my connection to spirit didn't really help. And what I'm finding now is the combination of the two. So letting myself be an animal and very human,
mm-hmm.
and letting myself feel is just part of being alive, combined with a deep sense of connection to source and spirit. And so really
yeah.
bouncing between the two, and I can get a clear sense now when I've sort of left by the wayside some aspect of spirit or some aspect of my human part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it really helped me to know that I wasn't alone, and, you know, there's so much amazing material that I read and I pulled from my conversations with you, and just knowing that I wasn't alone, and knowing that this is an archetypal transition and it's not even personal to me, you know, that
yes.
this is just what sensitive, thoughtful women in this era go through.
Yes.
And that this isn't just about me.
So. Yes, and I think it's going to be so helpful for people to hear you say that, because, you know, as hard as I've worked over the last 12 or 14 years or whatever, you know, Conscious Bride came out in 2000, and there's still so little consciousness on a mainstream level about what happens during the wedding transition or the motherhood transition. And there's still such an enormous fantasy about, you know, the joy and the bliss and the this and the that. And, you know, I think that is the number one reason why women have a hard time just surrendering to the difficult feelings, because they get engaged, they think they're supposed to be happy, maybe they are for a day or two, and then, boom, the panic hits.
Yeah.
And the first thought is, I must be making a mistake.
Yeah, and to be able to discern, that was a big one for me, to be able to discern between, you know, if there's a loud voice in me saying, no, don't, stop, make a change, it's mm-hmm. for me to be able to stop and be discerning of where's this voice coming from? Is this actually true? Is this actually a mistake I'm making as such, or is it that I'm outside of my wheelhouse, or I'm outside of my jurisdiction, and I'm in new territory here that is terrifying, and my ego just wants me to go back to my old comfortable ways, and
mm-hmm.
and for me not to be reactive, for me not to say, okay, because I'm freaking out, I'm calling something off, or I'm hitting a pause button. And while I think pause buttons sometimes are great, for me, I just wanted to barrel through any of the fear thoughts, knowing that
yep.
there were going to be a lot of voices that were attached to me being an individualistic person.
Yes.
And that I had to prepare myself for them and
yes.
to discern between the voices of, wow, this is a huge mistake versus it's, you know, it's not. And there are times where those voices come in that say it's a huge mistake and it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So to know, you know, it's that delicate discernment to know between, is this a fear voice or is this a God voice that is really leading me to make a better choice?
Yes. Yeah. And bravo, you did it.
I mean, thank you. I kept thinking of you. I was like, oh, Cheryl, where is she? I want to high five her.
You did it. I mean, it sounds like you were really pulled through the underworld for some days there, you know,
yeah.
and mm-hmm. that's what it can feel like when you are pulled through a transition and it's really kicking your butt, you know, and
yeah.
and asking you and inviting you and calling you to the next stage, and it is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what you said, barreling through those fear voices, and that's exactly what has to happen, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to have that discernment between what is fear and what is truth.
Yes, and even I also see that even if I were to have been, quote-unquote, making a mistake,
mm-hmm.
Barreling through the fear voices would still have served me.
Yeah.
So, you know, going through and looking one by one at the fear voices is always going to be a profitable endeavor, regardless
yes.
of what the outcome is.
Right,
yeah.
right, right.
Yeah.
yeah, and again, so important for people to hear because that's such a huge fear. What if I'm making a mistake? And the answer is, well...
We'll find out. Yeah,
we'll find out.
Yeah, and that's okay too, right? Because for me, it was like, oh God, I'm not allowed to make mistakes. The whole perfectionism thing came in.
Yeah, huge for people. Huge.
God. So it's like, okay, if I make a mistake, it's a mistake. And what does a mistake really even mean? You know,
right.
this is if life presents everything it presents for me in order to evolve, and that is in fact my number one priority, as you know, as I'd always wanted it to be. Then there are no mistakes. You know, so.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of reframing, and it was a huge existential crisis that was awesome. And, it, you know, I had a way of staving it off in the past and being really creative and finding ways to avoid certain crises. But this one, there's no way around it. For me, around the wedding and around becoming a mom, there was no way for me to slither out of it.
Well, there probably could have been a way, but you made a choice. I mean, there's 100,000 ways, especially around the wedding. And, you know, even if you're having a tiny wedding or if it's 100 people or 500 people, I mean, the wedding in and of itself keeps people so busy and so distracted. And that's where we get the bridezilla, you know.
Yeah.
That's the bridezilla focusing all of that energy and all of those feelings of being out of control
mm-hmm.
onto trying to control
yep.
The externals. So you could have, but you made a different choice. I mean, you knew that this was an opportunity.
Yeah.
And you grabbed it.
Yeah, and I'd been so controlling most of my life that the outcome of my control was never really a good outcome. So I knew that tactic wasn't really going to serve me anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
So another letting go there, you know, mm-hmm. consciously knowing that time to let that go at another level anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right.
And to keep my sense of groundedness and my alertness, but not to have it be that every little tiny detail had to be perfect. And thankfully, I'd had enough experience in producerial things, so production of events and shows
yes.
and tours and records, to the point where I'd learned through experience that such beautiful outcomes are birthed from showing up, doing the 50% showing up, but then letting grace and God take care of the other 50%.
Mm.
Because I think a lot of my, you know, a lot of, and one extreme is to say, oh, God will take care of everything, and no one shows up, you know, and it's a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other end where it's like, I'm going to just control every minute detail, and there's no room for the sweet grace to come in and help you out, you know.
So, yes.
So that middle moderation thing was really helpful for me in every area.
Yes, yes, I love it. So you are now in the midst of another enormous transition
mm-hmm.
Of being pregnant. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Such a wonderful, wonderful transition in so many ways, but not without challenges. And, of course, everybody's pregnancy is different, and everyone gets hit with the motherhood challenges at different times. You know, I know plenty of people that have a glorious pregnancy and a pretty easy labor, and then, you know, when their kid is two or their kid is one, you know, they get hit over the head.
It'll be interesting to see where I buckle.
Yeah, has it been smooth sailing, or where are you at with the pregnancy?
Again, that non-resistance approach has helped me because there were, you know, the first trimester, as I'm coming to learn, is somewhat predictable for a lot of women, was physically really challenging for me, especially with my having been super overachiever girl, over-functioning, over-responsible. All of a sudden, I was kind of flattened.
Yeah.
I had no energy, and I was like, oh, this is an interesting way for God to have me look at all of the things that would block me from being able to be available to this upcoming role of motherhood.
Mm.
So there were a lot of sticky wickets, as my friend said. There were a lot of things to look at. One of which was my workaholism. You know, I've always been sort of project after project, overscheduled. My calendars were almost, you know, humorous at how full they were. Sort of a busyness-aholic. So I quickly came to see that was actually unsustainable, especially if I wanted to have energy and focus for my blossoming relationship with my new husband, too. So I knew that there was a huge lifestyle change that was being required of me.
Mm-hmm.
But physically, it really, for me, my particular version of it is that it's really grounded my life in a way that nothing really required me beforehand to do it in this kind of a way. So I'm still in shock. I can't believe it. It's also, I was chatting with a friend of mine the other day saying that being pregnant really has pushed me back into my body in a way that I would avoid slightly, because I thought that one way of avoiding the pain of childhood wounds and the pain of trying to evolve and become my authentic self and move away from the false self that I'd constructed to survive in the world, all of that is really painful. And one way that I would avoid that would be to just focus on my spirituality, whereas being pregnant really slammed me back into my humanity and my body.
Yeah.
There's just no way to avoid it, right?
No way to avoid it. And when I talk about the transition of pregnancy, it's exactly that. I talk about it in terms of contractions and expansions, so that in that first trimester, it's such a profound contraction.
Mm.
And the body necessitates it so often through exhaustion and what we call morning sickness, which, you know, for lots of women is all day long and all night long. But and, you know, so that initial cocoon, you know, when you're going so deeply into your body, into yourself, and it's astonishing. I mean, women still can power through that if they refuse the call, if they refuse that invitation to slow down and surrender. But the body works very hard to say, come on, you know, time to go inward, time to contract, time to turn inside. And then the second trimester being a time of expansion for many people, and then third trimester again, going back inward, preparing for labor, you know, having those conversations with your baby, with your partner, you know, the final stages of grief and acknowledgement that this stage of your life is over, and, you know, what is only so much of that you can really touch on until you become a mother. You know, it's so abstract, but again, the pregnancy does help you because there's already so many limitations just from being pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And I often reference the example of a woman that I came into contact with in my first childbirth class who she came to speak to us, and she said that her doctor had ordered her to bed rest. She was a workaholic. You know, it was back in L.A., and she was Hollywood somebody, and and her doctor had ordered her to bed rest in her third trimester, and she kicked and screamed and fought and resisted it, but she had no choice. She had to.
Yep.
And bed rest is so often a blessing for women because it forces them to slow down, and she says it altered her entire experience of motherhood because she had already slowed down prior to the baby being born, and, you know, she didn't want to go back to work full time after that because she had, you know, tasted this other experience. Of slowness and being, and it's such a deeply feminine experience, and you know, you referenced that earlier of the archetypes, and, you know, of course, nothing more feminine than becoming a mother, but in feminine in the archetypal sense of those energies and qualities of being and receptivity and slowness, you know, and that non-doing quality, which is so lacking and is really at the heart of my work with transitions, because you cannot go through a transition consciously without slowing down and pausing and being connected to that feminine energy, regardless if you're a man or a woman.
Yeah, and especially for the alpha females, of which I consider myself to be one,
yes.
It really counters a whole identity. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've always maybe secretly prided myself on being maternal, but my identity of being very out in the world and active and productive, and you know, certainly these qualities aren't disappearing anywhere. But they're needing to be put on the back burner a little bit. So
yes.
All of a sudden, talk about rebirth into these whole new identities of not only the mother archetype, but although that one's not fully new for me, I think the beingness and the surrender and the taking things really slowly and patiently and pacing oneself. You know, there was a point, too, where a lot of the literature about, you know, the first year of a baby's life and all these books were beautifully being sent my way. However, you know, I got really clear about the fact that I wanted to just be in the week that I was in. You know,
yes.
I didn't want to be buying clothes for my child, you know, when they're 3 years old. It's like I'm still only a few weeks along here. You know,
yes.
So it really threw me back into the present moment. Also, on a psychological level, it's exciting to embrace a role that is really distinct and really appropriate in that I'm going to be maternal with this little creature, and it's
mm-hmm.
appropriate. It's not me parenting someone that, you know, that I shouldn't be parenting. It's not me
right.
being codependent. It's not me trying to be the mom to my employees. It's
yes.
like you're a mom to a child who's your child. It's very
yes.
clean.
Very clean and clear. Yes.
Yeah. So that's helped a lot. It's
yes,
being
beautiful.
Present with the learnings, too. And then I paced myself, too, whereas around the wedding, it was so all-encompassing. You know, there were a lot of decisions to be made, and I gave myself full permission to almost get lost in the whole process of it all. This pregnancy mm-hmm. process, maybe because there are 9 months
mm-hmm.
and it's a lifetime role that I'm taking on, I'm letting myself pace myself in the, you know, I'll watch a DVD or I'll read a book or I'll journal about it, and then I go into a whole other mode so that I'm not obsessively being pregnant woman.
Yes.
So that's helped as well.
Yes, and you'll have plenty of time, as you know. You know, it is such a, it's a lifelong endeavor, and as is marriage, but you can see the arc of it more clearly, I think, when you have a child. So just to transition a little bit, to the idea of rituals and the importance of rituals, I mean, the interconnectedness of rituals with transitions. And mm-hmm. our culture, just like it doesn't acknowledge transitions, it doesn't acknowledge the importance of using rituals to guide us through the transition. So I think you are somebody who utilizes rituals, and I would love to hear your thoughts on that. And I just want to start by reading a quote that I recently came across by Maladoma Somei in a book called Crossroads, and this is the quote. "Just as some Westerners can't conceive of life without running water, electricity, and MTV, indigenous people in tribal Africa can't conceive of life without ritual. People's lives on both sides are defined by their attachment to these things, and their attachments on each side are equally strong. But although ritual is an old ingredient in the rhythm of indigenous life, it has been replaced in the modern world with a number of things, including those mentioned above, and it seems its absence in the West is being felt at a great cost, namely in the general impoverishment of the psyche and the spirit. The inability of material accumulation to replace the craving for spirit, the loss of viable forms of community, and the all-out epidemics of isolation and individualism are symptomatic of the crushing effects of the abandonment of rituals. Where ritual is absent, the young ones are restless or violent, there are no real elders, and the grown-ups are bewildered. The future is dim. Consequently, we must stress that ritual is an inevitable and necessary component of human life. It will not suffer any substitution or deletion of memory." So I would love to hear your thoughts on this quote and you know, what rituals you have used personally for any rites of passages in your life.
Yeah, ritual is a huge friend for me.
Mm.
It's such an active part of me reparenting myself, too, because ritual in the West, as that quote spoke to, and as I've imagined you've spoken to many times, too, is sort of a dying art in a way.
Yeah.
It's tragic for me because it's such a marker. You know, it's such a rite of passage marker, and it's a celebration, and it's the honoring of whatever grief may come up. I also love to physicalize and dance and move, to move energy and to mark things. So art is a big piece to me. So whether it's by painting something or creating a collage or dancing, or for me on stage, I mean, a show, any show that I do is such a ritual. You know, it's like a shamanic expression and marking of a chapter. Even putting out a record is, I often call it a snapshot of a period of time in my life versus getting overly precious about it needing to be some seminal magnum opus.
Yeah.
Expression. You know, it's really just a marking point of a transition in an ongoing, evolving movement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So dancing is a big one for me. And then when I'm feeling less physical, being in nature, you know, feet in the ground is huge. Meditation, I have a bunch of altars upstairs in my room where I'll clear one off and I'll dedicate it to a certain thing. So I have a pregnancy altar upstairs where I have, you know, photos from any given ultrasound, or, you know, I have my own baby boots that I wore as a kid, and notes from my own mother. So creating altars is huge for me. I'm writing a book right now where I talk a lot about my practices. And then anytime a practice becomes overly rigid or too dogmatic, I just drop it, you know, and I'll go to something else. Listening to meditations, reading is huge. And then silence, big one, music.
What about the idea of ritual in community? Has that been a part of your life? Like the idea of having elders. I mean, this is where I feel such an impoverishment, to use his word, in our culture is, you know, we create these individual rituals, which are so powerful and important in our own, with for our own selves and our own homes. But I think for me, you know, as a mother with young children, I'm feeling it so much more intensely and with greater concern of how to raise children in the community beyond me and my husband, you know, recognizing that we are, you know, limited and imperfect and, you know, can only give our sons so much and, you know, the richness that comes from being in community, and yet we are not in community. We have a community, but we don't necessarily live in a community where those rituals are enacted around those pivotal rites of passages, you know, around, you know, my 5-year-old turning into a six-year-old, which for me has felt like this huge rite of passage, is entering into big boyhood, and he's losing his baby teeth, and he's getting his 6-year molars, and he's, you know, he's so clearly feeling out of control, and he's, you know, half the time he's just, you know, a little terror, and then he's like a mature 14-year-old, and, you know, he's just all over the place. He's in this huge transition, and so often I just, you know, I can offer him the words, I can offer him as much as I know, but I feel such a lack in terms of being able to offer him, you know, the greater community or time-honored or ancient rituals that just are not a part of our life.
Yeah, it's such a Western challenge. And I mean, first of all, I just have to say that I think your kids are really lucky that you're their mom. But
no, thank you.
But for ritual for me in community, I actually live communally, so I've always lived with people around. I can't imagine villagelessness. And not only for my future children, but also for my own self.
Yeah.
You know, I value my solitude, but solitude without a sense of pretty direct communal experience for me feels like half a life. And that may have had something to do with the fact that I grew up with a lot of vitality and movement and interaction as a kid, so it's just part of my nurture bones. But but I need people around, and whether they're circles or dinner times together or praying together, we do, you know, my friends and I do makeshift kind of workshops together where we'll sit around and, you know, sort of take turns playing coach with each other, and we give each other feedback, and you know, we'll watch a lot of DVDs together. So I think communalism is huge. Personally, for me, I would feel a huge loss if I didn't have it. And also, you know, if there were a void in grandparenthood or great-grandparenthood or the sort of larger scope of it, I always seek out replacements. So whether they're, you know, whether they're imaginary figures, you know, I have deities all over my house. or whether there are people that I meet who are, you know, 30 years older than me, and I, in my own mind, might maybe silently, maybe directly to the person themselves, say, you know, do you want to be my grandma? Will you be my mommy? So I have I have moms and dads and grandfather figures and, you know, little sister figure. I never had a sister, so I have all my, we call, I just call them the new family, you know. And and I think if I didn't have that, I'd, when in moments where I've been a little more isolated and disconnected from it, I feel really dead. I feel really not, there's no real sense of well-being for me. So keeping that alive has been huge. And I can tell when I'm too isolated. I can tell that I need human contact. And and for future children, I have what sounds like maybe the same concern that you have. I just think, God, you know, do I want to buy a big plot of land and have five homes on it and invite a bunch of people to live it? You know, live in those homes. And so the imagination till is going right now, and I'm coming up with ways to keep that alive, as it sounds like you're doing too.
Yep, that's the exact same thought we've had. You know, buy a plot of land and have five homes on it, and, you know, a big communal space in the middle, and, you know, and you take the rituals from there. So that's not what you have right now when you say you mean you live communally.
I have a home that has a bunch of rooms in it, and at any given time there are at least three or four of us living here.
So
that's sort of more inside the actual same dwelling version of community, which I love. And that's not for everybody, I realize. And then other people, it's living in the same street or in the same area. And then I have a lot of friends that live around me. So isolation simply wouldn't work. And I don't want to be the only figure that my children look up to, because I'm just one little creature doing her best. You know,
exactly.
So I want them to have this whole breadth and scope of people to look to. And also, I think necessity breeds form. So I would never really have to think about this unless I had children, and, you know, I intend to have more than one down the road. And so their coming into existence requires me to think about this.
I mean, that's how I felt. You know, I thought about it sort of tangentially, but certainly wasn't a big concern. And now with, you know, my older boy turning six, 12 doesn't seem that far away. And 12 being such an, you know, such an enormous rite of passage and such a tragically empty one in our Western culture in terms of adolescence. So, you know, I'm the wheels are spinning, the gears are turning about how, what's going to happen to create the transition in a meaningful way, to create the initiation ceremonies in a way that works. You know, I can't quite imagine sending him off to the forest for a week like some cultures do. I would
probably
flashlight
have a
heart attack.
Snacks. Good luck in your vision quest.
Front of the vision quest.
With the cougars.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's an option, Cheryl. Don't throw it out yet.
Maybe I spend the next 6 years preparing him and me for that. You know, I was reading in this book, Crossroads, which is about the adolescent rites of passages, how important it is for boys to separate from their mothers during that time. And, you know, I think that's right on, as much as that, just saying that can make me cry right now, but that's so important. For boys to then become men separate from their mothers, and we see so much in the culture how men have not separated from their mothers ever. And
that male
I think,
mentorship too coming into play. The whole concept of mentorship of the same gender, opposite gender. Having those figures be available to us, and if they weren't available in our actual nuclear family, there's nothing stopping us from just, you know, renting people.
I love it.
Had a lot of people who've, you know, wittingly or otherwise played the role of certain, you know, certain mentors or teachers for me along the way, and some of them stay for a year, and some of them are long-standing, you know. Whatever's needed. And I think there's such gratification to be found in playing that role, that there's a lot of very willing people to play that role for the younger generation.
Yes. And I think it's just a part of, you know, setting that intention and knowing that it's so important, and planting those seeds when the kids are young, you know, how to prepare them for their adolescence. Because, you know, again, in the context of transitions, we think of adolescence as this thing to get through, and, oh, your kids are adolescent, poor you. And, you know, it's looked upon with such negativity, and that it's this nightmare time. And, you know, the truth is that, like all transitions, there's such richness and potential for richness and transformation and growth as these young people are coming into their adulthood and asking the important questions of who am I and what is my place in this world and what is the meaning of life on earth. I mean, that's, you know, that's what characterizes adolescence, but they have no place to ask those questions. You know, they have no rituals to guide them through, so they end up creating their own rituals with, you know, gangs or cliques or whatever.
And they're desperate for the wisdom of the sage-like elder, right? So you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? It also could be the lack of ritual that is sort of seemingly dying in the Western world could also be a symptom of the fact that, you know, I'm generalizing, which is a horrible thing to do, but maybe as our generations age, you know, if wisdom were to go along with it, there might be more of a propensity for the younger generation to turn to them for that wisdom. But if there's still this sort of old hierarchical dictatorial approach to parenting, the younger generation isn't going to be as inclined to sit, you know, cross-legged at the feet of their elders who maybe are admonishing them for the new generation. And if evolution isn't embraced, you know, the cycle of turning to the elders for wisdom is itself going to be a dying concept. So, you know, maybe in Europe and maybe in Africa and maybe in some of these other cultures, there actually is this unconditional sage-like wisdom that is being passed down to the point where it keeps the ritual in place because there's such benefit to it. Whereas if there's not a lot of onus on growth and healing and evolution, the older chronologically we get, we don't really have much to offer to the point where the actual ritual and mentorship itself disappears.
Right. That's very beautifully said and a perfect segue into one of my final questions for you, which is that the idea that our world, our culture is in transition right now. And that we're being forced to relinquish the old ways and shift our paradigms toward a more sustainable and connected mindset and lifestyle. So I wrote recently on my Conscious Transitions blog, I think a lot about the state of our planet, which is so clearly in transition. There are some times when it seems like the world is falling apart. And in the context of transitions, that's exactly what's happening. Earth is falling apart. The old ways and old paradigms are no longer working. Whether it's the energy source that fuels our world or models of education, work life, marriage, and parenting, everything is shifting. It has to shift. The old ways have to die in order for the new ways to emerge. It's a scary time because we're hanging in the void of the unknown and we're watching so much crumble around us. We don't know how we're going to find our way out of this mess, but find our way we will. Amidst the disintegration, massive amounts of inventions and solutions are being born. Earth will renew itself. She always does. And we as a species will continue to evolve as we always have, creating a more sustainable, conscious world where all species thrive. So artists have always been the spearheads and visionaries throughout history, and I believe it's no different today. What role do you see yourself and your artistic community playing in helping heal the disconnection in our culture?
Wow. That's, first of all,
it's a big question.
You wrote that on your blog?
Yes.
That's awesome. So exciting. God, I
Thanks.
Got really energized. I feel, I don't know if the word responsible is really the word I would use. I feel inspired to be in a position where my songs or what I write is expressed publicly in some cases, but It's like anything. I think there are philosophers and therapists and writers and artists and mathematicians and bank tellers all over the planet, some of whom are sort of vocationally inspired to add to the conversation or be part of the larger conversation of evolution that's going on that you just described in what you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who are in the exact same position that are really here to simply entertain.
Mm-hmm.
And perform, and then there are other people who maybe are attracted to the job itself, but maybe aren't. You know, they're not fueled by a vocation. Maybe they're doing it because their parents said they should, or maybe they're doing it because society seems to value fame and wealth and notoriety so much. You know, so I think, regardless of the role, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a manicurist, whatever role, I mean, you're either actively part of the consciousness evolution conversation in your own unique way or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Although people are in art a lot of times in this really privileged position to be able to have the ear of people and take more
right.
of an active role in the conversation. So in that sense, I feel very inspired and privileged to be in this position. And I just have to be careful that I don't overdo it and turn it into some crazy messianic complex of like, I have to do this even though I'm exhausted, you know, which is what I
right.
used to do. I used to think, God, you know, God has given me these gifts and I must use them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only later that I started living by the credo that just because I can doesn't mean I should.
Yes, yes, or that you have to.
Yeah, so self-care combined with listening to the calling or the vocation has been really valuable for me. But this, I love what you said about up, you know, the sort of update or, you know, I wouldn't say update or die. I think I see a lot of people struggling against, you know, the new. You know, it can seem sacrilegious and blasphemous and horrifying to some people who have become very attached to a way, whether it's a religion or a dogma or
yes.
an approach. You know, it can be very threatening to their own survival in their own mind. So I can understand the kicking and screaming, but evolution is, you know, there's really no way around it. We can kick and scream or we can sort of gracefully move along with it
mm-hmm.
and actively be part of the conversation, but it's going to happen either way, right?
It is.
Yeah,
it's going to happen
exactly.
either way, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, the question is how to help people, you know, through the work that I do under, just give them the context that it is happening and there are ways to help lessen the resistance, you know, or accept the resistance as we're all going through this transition together on the micro and macro levels.
Mm.
You know, there's such a profound transition, and I think anybody who is, you know, a thinking person and a feeling person, you know, taps into what is happening on Earth right now is monumental, you
mm.
know.
Yeah, to let those of us who are maybe a little too traumatized at any given moment to activate, to not
mm-hmm.
shame the people who can't take the more sort of frontline active role in this movement, because I think there's a lot of – it became very trendy probably 10 years ago to be charitable and activism-minded. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so now we have – great, now we have the perfectionistic model applied to people who, quote-unquote, aren't, you know, carrying their weight in the helping save the planet movement. And I'm just like, oh,
right.
no, another excuse to beat ourselves up.
Right, like if my husband puts a roll of a used paper towel cardboard thing, you know, in the trash instead of the recycling.
You won't talk to him for 2 weeks? Punish. No,
yeah, my little perfectionist, my little activist, you know, Earth sender goes,
Must save planet. Yes.
Must save planet. Oh,
yeah.
Gosh, every roll of toilet paper counts.
Yeah, and you know, we're all doing the best we can, and I think for those of us who are more traumatized and feeling the effects of our abuse than others, you know, to give us, to cut us maybe some more slack to do the inner work so that we can have the energy and have the self-care to be oriented towards service that is very particular to us and isn't overdone. You know, and then everyone has their unique contribution to make, and some of our contributions are more public than others, and that there's not one way to do this, and that it's happening anyway. So, you know, and I love what the Dalai Lama says, which is, you know, his religion is kindness, his religion is compassion, and that,
love
you know,
it.
It's incomplete if it's not provided for our own selves, and all those great one-liners.
Yes.
But,
yes.
So, yeah, I think it's a, you know, love is at the core of what this movement is all about. I think your mom says it so beautifully when she says some version of, you know, we're here to evolve in love. And it's for me, I think evolution and the growth of love is, they're sort of synonymous concepts. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, in terms of the artistic contribution to it, you know, I feel so blessed that I can combine all the sensual aspects of sound and visual and physicality and spirit, you know, that they can all converge on stage or in the studio. You know, I am constantly grateful every day to God that I have these mm-hmm. gifts. And then I have to be vigilant about not overdoing them because of some should drive, you know,
mm-hmm.
some beating myself up drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Well, beautifully said, and I just so, so appreciate you taking the time. I could sit here and talk to you for 10 more hours. But,
yeah, me too, you.
But is there anything else you'd like to add or say on this topic of transitions?
I'm just so excited that you have shone the light on it in the way that you have, and your books have been so helpful to me and helpful
Good.
To a lot of my girlfriends, and I'm very grateful to you, and anything I can do to support, you know, being part of the conversation with you, I'm excited to do.
Thank you so much. I think that you will give a lot of people inspiration to know that when they're in that existential fear and anxiety, that transitions bring that with enough information and commitment, they will be able to reach the other side and experience the new birth, the new beginning. I think it's one thing to know that intellectually, but and it's one thing to have me say it or to hear it in a book, but you know, to hear somebody who's really gone through it and has so recently gone through it, I think will really give people, you know, the rope to hang on to when they feel like they're drowning. So thank you so much.
Thank
really,
you.
Really appreciate it.
Oh,
yeah.
You're welcome. You're creating the community that is so wanted. You're creating it over the Internet, which is, I think, a really viable way to do it.
I think it is, too. I think the Internet, you know, can be a mixed bag for people in transitions because they end up trying to seek so much reassurance for those questions of doubt and am I making a mistake, and you know, ultimately it's like what you came to, that place of arriving at the acceptance of the uncertainty is what has to happen in order to keep moving forward, and that it becomes somewhat of an addiction to keep checking the message board and keep checking the, you know, am I making a mistake and is this normal, and you know, part of it being that there's just so much misinformation around these enormous life transitions that it's really hard for people to believe that it is normal and a necessary process.
Mm-hmm. And that if there is some decision that they're making that is, quote-unquote, the mistake, that'll become clear in time, too.
Such a key point. Such a key point. Yeah. So important for people to grasp that and to have that acceptance, you know, and what comes up in the perfectionist mind is that it's not okay. And so that's such a huge growth point, learning curve, to know that it is okay, you know, to really redefine what a mistake even is.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Alana.
Thank you so much. This is really great. Thanks so much for having me. I feel honored.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day and a pat to your belly.
Thanks so much, and I'll be in touch.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.